speaking on this program is Brother Gary Cawley.
Most important decision that will ever be made in your life. Of course, the first most important would be obedience to the gospel. And we notice Hebrews 13:4, where Jesus said through the Apostle Paul, "Marriage is honorable and all, and the bed undefiled. But the whoremonger and the adulterer God will judge." This is to be before us all. Marriage is honorable in all, before all, and it must be continued that way. I know that those of a humanist nature, atheist nature, have tried to change that now. They don't want marriage to be an honor. All of our media processes are turning us away, if they can, from the marriage that God intended. They don't care. They want to use everything that is foul and perverted that they can possibly get to try to dull your senses about what's right and what is wrong. But it still teaches us this in the text, that whatsoever God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. And that each one of the man or the wife is to love severally his own wife, even as himself. Let the wife see that she reverence her husband. And he who findeth a wife findeth a good thing, and the favor of Jehovah, Proverbs 18:22. So these verses bring before our minds the importance of our subject. And certainly as we study these things, I think that each of us can profit from them. I know that our young people can and should. When we think about this, we realize that our world is a different world now than what it has ever been. I wouldn't say that the only time that we've ever had wickedness in the world was now, because even from the first, we find that God saw the wickedness of man was only evil continually in Genesis 3. And so because of that, God said, "I will send a flood upon the world of wickedness." And there were only 8 souls that he found that did his will and walked in his favor, and he saved those in the ark. But, indeed, we still find there are men and women who do not care about God's ordination. They do not care about the home fundamentals that we've been studying about. And so because of that, they have a very reckless way of living, and they pay for it. It is always sad to see the results of a broken home. And our society, as it seems in the decline and in distress, is that which moves faster and faster, it seems, toward that which is evil. We need to stop that thing. We need to turn it around, if possible, because of the deplorable condition that we're finding ourselves in. Since, indeed, there is above 50% of marriages that end in divorce, since there are children that are suffering, since there are hearts that are broken, then certainly we ought to see some difference insofar as changing our society to be like that which God would have it to be. The reoccurring difficulties of divorce over and over and over should cause us to understand it doesn't always happen just to the other person. We too need to be checking our own marriages. We need to be sure that what we're doing is in harmony with God's will. And if it is not, then we need to turn it around. Indeed, our marriage doesn't have to fail. And we would not hope or wish or even think about anybody's marriage failing, because we know that according to Malachi 2:16, God hates putting away. That is divorce. God hates it. Now, if God hates it, my friends, we ought to hate it also. When we notice this morning that the average marriage now lasts only 26 months, that's average. That's not something that we ought to say, well, that's about what mine will last. It ought to be, of course, that we don't even intend to have a divorce in our family. We ought to marry once, only once, and that be a lifetime. And when we think of it in that way, then we maintain that marriage and cultivate that marriage in the right way that the Lord would have us to do. But the neglect of children is up 330%, so we're told, and that distresses us, doesn't it? We don't like to see the children suffer. But what else can they do when the parents are not in the home, when the parents are not teaching and nurturing these children? Indeed, it is a shame and a disgrace that children have to be brought up in the way that they are. Talk to some of our school teachers. If you don't believe there's a hard situation out there, they'll be glad to tell you. They can tell the difference in mothers and daddies that are home seeing about their children and mothers and daddies that are not. They can see it in the children. And the children, of course, when they suffer, we all ought to be ashamed. Indeed, there's a lot of violence. And the battered women, the battered husbands, the battered children ought to be having a stop put to that. Statistics, of course, are against us so far as crime is concerned. They're against us so far as rape is concerned, violent crimes, And sadly, our young people are turning to drugs because nobody's there to supervise them. Nobody's there to say, now listen, this is not the way to go. This will harm you. This will kill you. And so because of that, it seems we need parents even more in the home. We suggested this morning we need to teach more on how to be married and what it means in God's sight and what God intended for a happy home, and that He did never intend that man should put away his wife or wives should put away their husbands. How to pick a mate's important, isn't it? And how to keep a mate's important. How to resolve the marital difficulties that are there. All of these things are in the home fundamentals. And that's what we want to study in the next few lessons that we shall have. Let me read you something here from 1,700 years ago. That's a long time, isn't it? That goes back to the second or the third century A.D. This is Tertullian. And listen to it and see if it doesn't sound like what you read in the Bible today. Beautiful is the marriage of Christians, he wrote. Two are one in hope, one in the way of life they follow, one in the religion they practice. They are both servants of the same master. Nothing divides them, either in flesh or in spirit. They are two in one flesh, and where there is one flesh, there is also one spirit. They pray together, they worship together, instructing one another, strengthening one another. Side by side, they visit God's church. Side by side, they face duties and persecutions. They share their consolations. They have no secrets from each other. They never bring sorrow to each other's hearts. Unembarrassed, they visit the sick. They assist the needy. They give alms without anxiety. Psalms and hymns they sing. Hearing and seeing this, Christ no doubt rejoices. And to such as these, He gives His peace. Where there are two together, there He is also present. And where He is, there evil is not. Now that's 1,700 years ago. And that was the observance of Tertullian about what Christians did in their home and in their marriage. Now, you wouldn't see quite that many things in the regular, normal, worldly home, would you? In fact, none of those things would be present there. But in the Christian home, every one of them ought to be present. It has not changed from the time that that was given until now. It still should be that those who are in harmony with God's will be doing the same thing. You know, there's certain questions that every young person ought to ask before marrying a mate. And these questions are important. It happens over and over and over, it seems. Some Christian person, young lady or young man, will fall in love with one who is not a Christian. And because of that, they become engaged. Soon the date is set, and they're going to be married. No matter what may be their religious background. They choose their tableware with great caution. They choose the songs that will be used in their wedding. They choose the young ladies that will assist the bride, the young men that will assist the groom. And they decide where they'll go on their honeymoon. In all their preparations, though, it's easy to overlook the most important matter. That is, whether or not, what is going to happen if you don't marry a Christian. You know, we ought to be thinking of that. That's the most painful question there is, and it needs to be faced squarely, doesn't it? Because planning to marry someone who is not a Christian is as dangerous as carrying a shotgun close to your head. Number one, you ought to ask, am I willing to accept the possibility that my mate may never become a Christian? Do you know only one out of five do? When marriages are committed on this type of a thing, only one out of five convert their mates. Did you know that? That's very low, isn't it? That's not very high. Second of all, am I prepared to keep on going alone whenever the services of the church are meeting? If my mate refuses to come with me, will my mate resent my being gone during these times? Have you met that question yet? Have you asked that question? If you don't think that won't come up, you're wrong. You ask someone who is married, one who is not a Christian, and you'll find out that comes up immediately almost. Number three, am I sure that I want to place myself in the position of being unable to share the most important thing in my life with the most important person in my life? If you're not able to talk about the religion which you follow, if you're not able to talk about putting the kingdom first and living for the Lord, then who are you going to talk to about? Who are you going to mention it to? And here's the most important person in your life, and you can't even talk to them about these important matters. Fourth of all, will my mate understand my desire to put the Lord first in all things, including the budget? When I get ready to give, am I going to find a great difficulty here? Am I going to find that my mate doesn't believe in Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God, and therefore has no care for his church and no care for what is done there? Have you thought about that? That's more important than choosing the silverware, I can tell you. And then number five, what about the children? Now here's the clincher. Is it fair for them to grow up in a divided home where they're going to be pulled in two directions, where they will turn out to be strong? Will they be strong? Will they be faithful Christians? What will be the end of these children when one of their parents is not a Christian at all? Let me tell you, friend, just as in algebra, two negatives make a negative, one positive and one negative make a negative too. And you know, that really works in life a whole lot too. For some reason, the negative has the upper hand. For some reason, the negative in a marriage has the upper hand. Number six, how fine a person my marriage partner may be, am I prepared to face the fact that we are going to in different directions, on different roads, toward different destinations? How will I feel should my mate die out of Christ? What shall be my thought on that? How sorrowful I would be if I knew the one most important to me in life had not gone to heaven. Number seven, am I letting myself be swept along by my emotions? Have I considered what the Lord would want me to do? That's more important than the honeymoon too, isn't it? And then number eight, am I sure that this is the right person for me? I believe those are questions that should be asked. I believe they're questions that have to be answered. And if they're not answered, I think there will be a time when sorrow will come upon you as a flood. So when we think about this, marriage is honorable, marriage is right, marriage is good, marriage is beautiful, marriage is for two people to come one. But they have to think about these things because they're different plans that God has for marriage from what the world has. The world doesn't plan marriage the same way God does. The world says, lust reigns supreme. And if you can't find the most beautiful one with the greatest of packaging, then you oughtn't to marry. But when you find that one, that's the one you want to go for. Let it be a character that doesn't really count in the world. He's a character or she's a character that does not have any regard for the Lord, any regard for His church, any regard for whether or not my feelings are met, any regard for whether or not our children will be brought up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. You mean to tell me those aren't important things? Oh, they are. Yes, they are. We learned this morning that the origin of marriage is important. God made man, then God made woman. God was made or making man or making woman from man and for man. And woman needs to realize that position. But both of them complement each other. They're made perfectly in all unison for this marriage relationship. And it is for their happiness, for their joy, that they involve themselves in this relationship. But tonight, what is God's purpose in the marriage? If you don't know that, we need to know it, don't we? There are three different things are God's purposes in marriage. And all three of these are highly important. They somewhat are like what we discussed this morning, except it draws it down to the three real purposes that God has. First of all, to provide companionship. Genesis 2:18, God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. So here's the companionship that God provided. God made woman after saying that. And He made her so that she might be the companion of man. And that was number one in the purposes of marriage for man. Second of all, there is a command given in the book of Genesis to propagate the race. If that command is given, then we need to be sure we know about it. In Genesis 1:28, we find the Bible saying there, concerning these things, God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Now we have PETA and some of these organizations that say, oh, the animals are more important than people are. Well, God never thought that way. God thought the animals were to be subdued and under the oversight of man. But He told them, as He blessed them, gave them special protection, that they should multiply, be fruitful, and replenish the earth. Now, some don't want to do that because they don't want the responsibilities of bringing up children. And because they don't want those responsibilities, they don't bring children into the world, and they live a life of self-centeredness and selfishness until they come to the close of life. Nobody has any care for them, and they begin to whine, oh, why doesn't somebody care for me? Well, if you go back a ways, you'll find you didn't care for anybody. You didn't care enough to bring children into the world, and that was God's intention as you propagate the race, that those children should also see to your needs after you're older. In Romans the 7th chapter and verse 4, he said, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, ye also are made dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you should be joined unto another, even to him who is raised from the dead, that we might bring forth fruit unto God." Now, bringing forth fruit as Christians is to bring forth the fruits of the Spirit. It's also to cause others to become Christians. And it is also true that marriage is for that purpose too. It is indeed to propagate the race. So there's number two in the reasons for marriage. Number three, to prevent sin. Now, if you can't see that, turn to 1 Corinthians 7:2. He said, "Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife." That's the simple rule. To do what? To avoid fornication. Why? Because fornication is a sin. Why? Because fornication will cause you to be lost. Why? Because fornication is indeed hated by God. So, to avoid fornication, what are we going to do? Let every man have his own wife. Let every woman have her own husband. So we understand that these things are indeed God's purposes in marriage, to provide companionship, to replenish the earth, have children, and also to prevent sin. Now there we find some very important thoughts because we see the home fundamentals, don't we? But let's go further in those home fundamentals and see what God's plan for marriage is. First of all, God's plan was never that a man should have more than one wife, nor that a woman should have more than one husband. You can't find that anywhere in the text of the Bible. If you find it, you be sure and let me know. The Bible's text says that man and woman are to be monogamic. Monogamic simply means one man for one woman for life. And that's the way it is. So we find that God gave Adam one Eve, and that was the way he intended it. That was one thing Eve didn't have to worry about, was him finding some other woman to take her place. And she didn't have to worry about him finding some other lady or her finding some other man. They were the only ones there. But God fixed it from the beginning like he wanted it. And indeed, it ought to stay that way. So when we see that Genesis 2:24, there he said, "Let a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife." Singular. Always in that manner. So man and woman can have only one scriptural companion at a time. And of course, the only reasons that we shall notice in a few minutes for them to have another companion after they have married one is only unfaithfulness and our fornication and death. So we notice monogamy. 1 Corinthians 7:2, every man have his own wife, every woman have her own husband. Matthew 19:4, we find that Jesus said, and he answered, Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female? And then he quotes Genesis 2:24. Therefore shall a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. So in noticing this, we find one of the home fundamentals. Do you realize that it is one man for one woman for life? You know, if our young people realize that, they're going to be careful who they date. They're going to be very careful whom they say yes to insofar as marriage is concerned, because it's a lot more than what sometimes the world would have you to believe it is. It must be monogamy. Second of all, it must be procreative. Procreative, of course, means that children are to be brought into the world. Genesis 1:28. There we find the Bible talking about that and saying they're to replenish the earth and multiply. And, of course, that is a part of marriage. Children are such a blessing. Children are a blessing not only when they're small, but they're a blessing when they grow up. They're a blessing if you raise them right all the days of your life. And it will be certainly that which will either bring joy or sorrow to your heart. I can guarantee you that. It depends on you. It depends on what you do in raising these children. But I suggest to you that there is no ideal home life without children. And yet, I know there's some by nature who are not able to have children, and therefore, this, of course, is a responsibility that is removed when that is the case. But that's God's plan for marriage. You know, he made an arrangement here, and it shows his wisdom in everything that he does. If you want a happy marriage, make it monogamic, procreative, and then third of all, patriarchal. Now, in government, we're talking about here, who's going to rule? Well, the father is the rule. And in Ephesians 5:23, he said, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is also the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body." So we find the house band here, the husband, which is simply that which means he surrounds the house. He holds it together. He is the one who is depended on to make the rules in this household. In Joshua 24:15, Joshua could say, "Choose you this day whom you will serve, whether it be the gods that your father served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose lands you dwell, but it's for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah." That's what he was going to do. Now, how could he say that? If he didn't have a wife who was in subjection to him, he couldn't have said it, could he? If he hadn't had children that he had taught in the right way, he couldn't have said that. But when he raised his children up, they were like Abraham. You know, God said of Abraham, he was able to command his children. And so it is. It ought to be with us. But if you don't start early, parents, you won't be able to command them. You have to start from the start. If you don't, you'll lose control. They'll be growing up like wild weeds. And nobody can handle them. Nobody can control them. Nobody wants to be around them because they are so wild. Well, that's a sad thing because that points back to the parents, doesn't it? Where's the father? Where's the mother? So here's God's plan, and his arrangement shows great wisdom, doesn't it? Monogamic, procreative, and patriarchal. But then fourth of all, his plan is that it be religious. God never intended for a home to not be religious. He intended for a system of faith and practice to be followed there because he knew the importance of it. So in Ephesians 6, 1 through 4, he says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, that thou mayest live long on the earth. And fathers, you provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord." So the children owe something to the parents. The parents owe something to the children, don't they? Very important thought here. As Christians, we should act in the Lord as parents. And when we do, children are to obey parents who are in the Lord. And then he says, provoke not, don't make unreasonable demands and rebuke upon your children. Now there's a happy medium there. We are to discipline those children, but we're not to rebuke them to where they have no care. We are not to make them to where they cannot please us. We are not to go so far as to not train ourselves as Christians ought to. So Colossians 3:20-21 says, "Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. And fathers, provoke not your children, that they be not discouraged." That they be not discouraged. So we have God's plan here. Very wise, isn't it? You can see the wisdom of it. But how few people listen. How few people will take the simple rules that are laid down here and say, "Look, I'm not too sure I want God's plan for my marriage." Well, you better, because it's wise. And because for a happy marriage, it's the only thing that works. You know, if you marry a Christian, that makes your home the religious home it ought to be. And if you do not, it's going to be a difficult situation for you. Not that you can't bring that mate to Christ. No, no. There have been many who have, but there have been more who have not. So when we see it, we need to be careful about that point, don't we? Now, the greatest human contract in all the world is the marriage contract. That's the reason some people today don't want to enter into it. They know it's a binding contract. It is till death do we part. Friend, there's nothing else that I know of in the world you'll agree to like that, do you? Except the marriage of two people. Have you ever agreed in any other situation, till death do us part? You wouldn't do that in a business situation, would you? You wouldn't make a contract like that. But here in the marriage situation, you're making a human contract that's indissolvable. And if you don't think about it that way, you just think about it, well, it's like a date. You know, if I don't like this one, I'll get another one later. That won't work in marriage. This is indissolvable. It's to be broken only by death. Romans 7, 1 through 4. He said the husband or the wife is under the rule of the husband until he dies. And then she's free to be married to whomsoever she will. But 1 Corinthians 7:39 says about the same. She's under the law of her husband until he dies, and then she can marry but only in the Lord. In other words, here's a protective thought for this lady. She's to marry one who is a Christian. That's what in the Lord means in every place it's used in the text of the Bible. So here is one reason that she can remarry if he is dead. If he has passed on to his reward, then second of all, if infidelity is involved here. Matthew 19:9, he said, "Whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery, and whosoever marrieth her that is put away committeth adultery." Now, there's something wrong with the way I quoted that, isn't there? You know what it was? I left the exception out, didn't I? Whosoever, it's a universal term. Whosoever putteth away his wife, that's divorce. And marrieth another, that's the second marriage, committeth adultery. But now let's put the exception in. Whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. So we understand that there is one exception, and that is fornication. Now sometimes these new translations want to say marital unfaithfulness. Oh, come on now. Surely you know the difference in marital unfaithfulness and fornication. Fornication is a specific act. One of them wants to say, now you just be in chastity. Chastity? Well, my friends, one who is a thief might be a chaste person in some ways, but he still may not be a fornicator. You know, fornication is the only cause that you can put away a mate and marry again and be right in the sight of God. So in noticing that, it is indeed important that we understand. Now, in the Old Testament, one who committed adultery was put to death. We don't do that now because we're not under that old law. Now, if you want to be under the old law, I think you need to know that that's what happens to adulterers. I don't know of any who are obeying that today, but still in Leviticus, the 20th chapter and verse 10, the guilty party was to be stoned. But in the New Testament, they're simply forbidden to remarry. They have forfeited the right of marriage. When they have committed adultery against the husband of their youth, then they are not allowed to remarry. So here are some of the things that God has planned for marriage and how important they are. And I think we would be wise to look at them, don't you? The expressions of marital love, of course, first of all, is physical love. 1 Corinthians 7, 3-5. That is to be love that is needful, it's beautiful, it's fulfilling between husband and wife. And it is that which is taught as being that which is given the fullness of that which they are due. And they're not to defraud the other by withholding that relationship. So there's the physical love. Then there's the mental and the social comradeship. One in purpose, one in aim, one in design. Sharing all the difficulties and all the joys of life. It's a wonderful thing to have that mental and social comradeship. And then there's that spiritual growth together, how important that is. If we're all Christians, or if we're both Christians, then of course it's going to be an easy course. If we're not, it's going to be hard. You see, it takes more than a house to make a home. You've heard that, haven't you? It's true. It takes more than a house to make a home. You may have a beautiful house and have a bunch of fighting people that hate each other. But it may be an ideal housekeeper also in this home, but she may be destitute of being a homekeeper. Homekeeper and a housekeeper are two different things. And you know the child that's raised by a good housekeeper is to be pitied unless that one is also a good homekeeper. Because the home is that which the Lord wants, and it's a wonderful place to cultivate the spiritual Christian graces where we can add faith and virtue and knowledge and temperance and patience and godliness and brotherly kindness and love to our lives. 2 Peter 1, 5-11. And we realize that if a home is divided, it's going to be very difficult to have those worship services there. It's going to be very difficult to have these things added to the life of a child or to our own life. And so it is a wonderful place, if it is the right kind of home, to cultivate those Christian graces. And then again, we understand that the husband and the wife ought to work together for the Lord. And that's the beauty of all of those we find in the text of the Bible. For instance, you take Timothy's thought concerning elders, or Paul's thought to Timothy concerning elders. He said they're to be the husband of one wife. Why? Because that's what is needful in working together for the Lord. Now, you don't want an elder who is not married. You don't want a preacher who is not married. Why not? Because you know there's some difficult situations they may get themselves into that it would be so much better if they had a wife. And you realize the wisdom that of what I'm talking about. Now, if they are indeed helpful to each other, as Priscilla and Aquila, you remember in Acts 18, they called aside Apollos and they taught him the way of the Lord more perfectly. What a wonderful team in Aquila and Priscilla. And there's also those older women who are to train the younger women in Titus 2:5. Well, that shows indeed that they're to train them to work with their husbands in the ways of the Lord. Well, there are certain keys by which you can have a happy marriage. And those keys, of course, are established by divine appointment to fulfill man's best interest. And anything that God says is for our good. If we don't listen to it, that's our fault. That's something that we are to be guilty of. But now more than ever, these divorces that are coming and God-hating putting away, the truth is that marriages don't need to fail. And so let's teach people how to make them work. Number one, the key to open the beauties and the blessings of marriage is thoughtfulness. If you have that key, friend, you'll go a long way in marriage being good. That's appreciation. Now, if you don't appreciate your mate, if you're not thoughtful toward that one whom you have married, if you have quit being thoughtful when you had the I do's at the wedding, you're going to have a problem. Just little courtesies. It doesn't take much. Little thoughtful things, careful respect, kind words, good partings and loving greetings, all of these things add to cultivating that marriage relationship. Thoughtfulness, appreciation. Everybody wants to be appreciated, don't they? And so it is in marriage. Now, you can have a very long evening, husbands, when you come in and say, well, what did you do today? You can say that in another way and make it altogether different. What did you do today? That doesn't sound the same, does it? But that thoughtfulness is what really counts. That's key. That's a key. So if the husbands and the wives would find the happiness that they desire here, they need to use that key. Second key, of course, is forgiveness. At best, we're all going to offend and be offended in any relationship, but especially one this close. And so since there is that need for forgiveness, you know, when Jesus talked about the brethren forgiving each other, he said it's unlimited. Under 70 times 7, if a man comes and says, I repent, we are to forgive that man. And if he comes and says it again, we're to forgive him again. Well, it ought to be even more than that, perhaps, in marriage. Husbands and wives must be willing and anxious to forgive. They must never store up offenses. You know, sometimes when a husband and wife begin to argue or they have a little spat, they can pull up things that happened 20 years ago. They can say, well, you know what you did then, and you know different today, and this and that. But you know, 1 Corinthians 13:5 says that love taketh no account of evil. So it doesn't store up that evil. It doesn't say, well, I'll forgive you, but I'll never forget it. No, no. That's not love. All right, so the first key is thoughtfulness. The second key is forgiveness. The third key is worship. Worship, of course, means the devotion which we have toward God. And this, again, goes back to the need for both to be Christians. How are you going to have that family worship if both are not Christians? Is it going to be an objectionable thing? I wanted to watch TV, she may say, or he may say. So it would be impossible to have this family routine of worship. What are the children going to do? Well, they're not going to have it. And then the regular worship in the services of the Lord's church? What's going to be about that? That's one of the keys to a happy marriage, to be able to worship together. And you know, drawing this family closer to God is going to draw them closer to each other. When they pray together, when they work together, when they are worshiping together, that draws them closer. Surely you can see that the best single solution to the building blocks, the fundamentals of the home, is Jesus Christ. Because His teaching cannot be improved upon, and there are no better rules than His. He came to give us the abundant life. John 10:10, He said, the thief cometh not but to steal, kill, and destroy, but I've come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. Now, that life can be yours. That life can be a part of your interest in life if it is that which you're able to subscribe to. But, of course, God has promised only that the house of the righteous will stand. And if your house is not a house of people who are righteous walking in the will of the Lord, of course, there's no promise it'll stand. But when you do the will of the Lord, it will stand. It'll stand the test of time. And when you close your lives out upon this earth, you will be so grateful that you followed the will of the Lord, that you listened to what He said, and indeed that you joined hands and hearts to do His will and to live for Him who gave Himself for you. You just cannot improve or family building blocks on what the Lord has taught. And so, my friends, if you're not a Christian tonight, do you not see the importance of becoming one? Do you not see that you're robbing yourself and you're robbing your family? And therefore, you may cause your soul to be lost. If you need to obey, we have everything in readiness. The clothing is here. The water is here. There's no reason in the world why you can't become a Christian tonight. And it'll mean so much to your family. And if you are a Christian and yet you have not lived a Christian life, Your family knows that too, don't they? And they know if you've not lived up to that which the teaching of the Bible gives. So if you need to be restored tonight, this would be a wonderful time. Or if you've come into our city and you've not placed your membership with any congregation in the city, we'd be happy to have you worship and work with us here. And so if you need to come at all, please come now. While together we stand and while we sing.